Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Psychologist and author Cordelia Fine has had enough of what she calls neuro-nonsense. Research assertions that men and women are hardwired to be different. So she dug deep into the academic literature and found that, by her lights, it came up short. She could find no convincing evidence that men are from Mars and women from Venus in their very physiology, in their brains. She wants us to think about gender in a new way. This hour on Point, Cordelia Fine, re-examining the difference between men and women. You can join the conversation. Have you come to accept that men and women are hardwired to be different? Or is it our society, our cultural training, and not our brains that distinguishes the sexes? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Diego, California, is Cordelia Fine, psychologist, writer, and research association at the Center for Agency, Values, and Ethics in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Her new book is Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. Cordelia Fine, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Have to ask you first, everybody okay back in Australia? We know Sydney is not Brisbane, but the pictures there have been unbelievable, the flood. My gosh.
It just goes from one extreme to another, dry to wet. Yes.
Yeah, wet as can be. And what about this focus on gender? Does this run in the family? Your mom wrote the book that became Mrs. Doubtfire. Talk about a sort of gender bender, dress and go book. She's an author of many children's books. Is it a family area of interest across the generations?
Well, she also wrote a wonderful book called Bill's New Frock, which is about a boy who wakes up one day wearing a pink dress, and he lives the life of a girl for a day, and which is quite revealing for him. So, look, we didn't spend our dinner times discussing social construction of gender, I have to say, but who knows what the connection is.
All right, let's dive in here. There has been so much, and you point to example after example in the academic literature, in the popular literature, in the last, what now, I don't know, it seems like a couple of decades, the men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and that entire school of thinking, backed up by images from MRIs and new technology, helping us to peer into the activity of the brain. And out of that, many people, maybe you'll give us a little litany here, but many people have come to the conclusion that what tradition told us is true, that it's baked in the cake, it's in the brain, men and women different. And here you come saying no. Why?
Well, yes, neuroimaging is a very exciting new technology for neuroscientists to use. And I think there's a perception amongst the public that, you know, this is really it. We can actually, as you said, sort of peer into the brain and, in a sense, see who we really are, that this is a very reliable, objective new scientific method for finding out, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty of the answers about the differences between the sexes. But there are really four main issues with these use of MRI scans and functional neuroimaging scans, which is where you see the sort of brain in action, so to speak, in terms of understanding what it means for differences between men and women. And the first problem is a real issue, which is a problem of spurious results. So you just, you know, every so often, just by chance, you're going to get a difference between two groups in brain size or in brain activity. It's just an unfortunate problem of the fact that science is probabilistic by nature.
Ms. Fine, give us a little sense of what we may need to catch up with you here. What is the kind of thing people are seeing? You say it may be spurious, but what has been observed that has led people to the idea that there's a fundamental brain difference between the genders?
Okay, so one nice example of a spurious result is a very popular influential idea is the idea that the male brain is more specialised in the way that it's organised than the female brain, especially, for example, for language. The idea is that when men are processing language information and possibly other kinds of information, they tend to just use one side of their brain, whereas women tend to use both sides of the brain. Now, there was an imaging study that was published in 1995, that did indeed show for one kind of language task this kind of pattern. Mm-hmm. And this is often, you sort of often see this in popular research is showing, yes, indeed, you know, men and women's brains are organised differently. But actually, lots of studies of this sort have been done. And when you pool all the results together, so you have one bigger, much more reliable study with lots of subjects, what you find is that men and women are processing language in the same way. They're both tending to just use the left side of the brain. There aren't any sex differences. But what you find is especially when you have small sample sizes of men and women, which is surprisingly common in neuroimaging studies, of sex differences, you will just by chance get sex differences in the brain. And there are lots of scientific reasons to worry about this issue of whether a particular finding that you get will withstand the test of time, of bigger sample sizes, and also better methodology. So neuroscientists are continually improving the statistical techniques they use to analyse their data and so on and so forth. Mm. And as I said, reports of sex differences often, not always, but often have rather small sample sizes. So this is a real issue, and this idea that the male brain is more compartmentalised or specialised in the female brain is an excellent example of this problem.
You call these, right in your title, delusions of gender, but how are ordinary people supposed to make out who's got the right angle here? I mean, you can look back, you know, here you are, a psychologist, all kinds of wonderful degrees, but then we look at Simon Baron Cohen, his book, The Essential Difference. He's a psychologist out of Cambridge University. And, of course, as you report, he writes, the female brain is predominantly hardwired for empathy. The male brain is predominantly hardwired for understanding and building systems. So here's another scholar. He looks at the research. He comes down with that very sort of, you know, no mincing of words conclusion. Is it the research that's driving his conclusion? Is it something else? And how are we supposed to make out who to follow here?
Well, it is terribly hard. And I actually think that part of the issue is that researchers do tend to work in you know, one area of research, and they may not be terribly aware of other areas of research. So, for example, when it comes to Simon Baron Cohen's work, he relies a lot on self-report measures of empathising. So to what extent are you able to understand what another person is thinking or feeling and respond sympathetically to them, and what he calls systemising, which is basically understanding how the world works, how system works, like a physical system or a legal system. Now, the problem is that when you take the ability to understand what people are thinking and feeling, there's actually a large body of research showing pretty comically that what people's perception of how good they are at understanding what people are thinking and feeling actually bears little or no relationship to how good they actually are at doing these things. So you can be someone who has a very positive sense of your social sensitivity, and yet someone who goes sort of crashing through life, sort of trampling on people's feelings without even realising it. So if you actually want to know whether men and women are sort of hardwired differently for empathising, a good way to do it is to actually give them a test of that ability. Put them in the room with somebody and film it, and then go through it and say, what was that person thinking at that point? What were they feeling? And then compare that to what the person actually said. When you do that, you don't find sex differences. Where you do find sex differences is if you just give people a questionnaire and say, how good are you at this? How sympathetic are you? Yes, women come ahead then, but, you know, there are all sorts of reasons to do with, stereotypes and social expectations as to why that should be so.
It's so interesting. Now, there's so much complexity in here, because in the end, I'm reading here all the way to the last pages of your book, you're not entirely denying differences, but you're saying the differences themselves, the brain is very plastic, it can change depending on its environment and context and signals, and in that plasticity it may be responding to what? Nurture, not nature. You may find some difference, and even then you're saying, but that doesn't mean it's a fundamental difference. That may be a difference created by environment, by culture, as I read you.
Oh, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think it's an important point that in the brain doesn't mean innate. I mean, our brains respond to experience in response to learning and so on and so forth. And you can say, well, you know, where else but in the brain would we see the effects of gender socialisation. I mean, in the brain doesn't mean that it's hardwired, and I think that's a mistake that's often made by popular writers. And it's also the case that it's not the thesis of my book that there is, you know, no natural limit to sex equality. There may be. There are sex differences in abilities and achievements, so these are generally diminishing over time. Really, my thesis is that currently the state of the science doesn't justify that door being slammed in our face. It is far from conclusive. I was surprised just how shaky the foundations of the science are. And really what I came to realise is this is just a pattern. So for as long as there's been brain science, there have been these premature speculations as to, you know, why women are intellectually inferior, why women shouldn't be able to vote, why women shouldn't go to university, and so on and so forth. And, you know, eventually as the science progresses and as society progresses, and we no longer need a sort of biological account of why women shouldn't go to university or vote, these hypotheses, you know, they get thrown on the scrap heap eventually. But in the meantime, until this happens, what they do is they reinforce our sort of social attitudes about the differences between men and women in a harmful way that sort of creates self-fulfilling prophecies. And I came to realise, well, this is still happening. We're still drawing premature conclusions from the science.
You write, neuroscience is used by some in a way that it has often been used in the past to reinforce with all the authority of science old-fashioned stereotypes and roles. Is this really a scientific fight, or is it a political fight you're in the middle of here, Cordelia?
Well, obviously, sex differences, the science of sex differences has very high political stakes because it goes right to the heart of questions about, well, will we ever have sex equality in science? Will we ever have sex equality in any realm of occupation? Because whatever occupation you look at, men tend to, the higher up the sort of hierarchy you go, the fewer women you find. So, of course, it goes right to the heart of politics and, you know, how should we try and increase equality? Should we try and increase equality? Are we sort of railing against implacable nature? So it's a sort of inherently political issue, but my beef is scientific rather than political.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about men and women and whether there is really, finally, a fundamental difference in their brains. My guest today says no. Wow, have we gone round and round on this? Cordelia Fine writes in her new book, Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference, that we are misinterpreting the technology's latest evidence, and maybe we're doing it out of neurosexism, as you hear right there. She joins us today from San Diego. And Cordelia, lots of callers for you. Well, here's one, Anne in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. You're on the air with Cordelia Fine.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to ask a question. I agree that the science which is addressing this issue should be rigorous, and we should look at it carefully. But I'm just wondering whether the author, first of all, has any children, because I wanted to believe that differences were culturally imposed when I had my four children. Mm-hmm. And with my little N of four, I have to say that my point of view has changed. So I just wonder whether or not she's experienced this herself, because I think parents are very up close and personal reporters and observers.
Anne, stick with us. Cordelia Fine, what about, do you have direct experience with your own children? Has it shaken your view?
Well, I think it's actually illegal to write a book about gender if you don't have children. So,
or maybe should be.
luckily, I have two. So, yes, I am a parent, and it turns out that when you write a book about gender, and you know, you're chatting to the other parents in the schoolyard, and you tell them that's what you're up to, a very common response is very similar to that of Anne's, which is, well, you know, I used to think that it was all socialization, but then I had my own children, and you know, I realised that it couldn't be. This is a very common perception. And I think what we need to think about here is the environments that babies are born into. So babies are born into a world in which sex is the most important social division. It's emphasised continually through language, through dress, through the division of labour and so on and so forth. It's also a world that is absolutely saturated with information about what goes with being male and what goes with being female. This is especially so, I think, for children. And it's also populated with people who have minds that are full of assumptions and expectations about gender. And that goes however sort of egalitarian you are in your beliefs. And however egalitarian your intentions are. And I think, given the social circumstances, it would actually be rather amazing if boys and girls did behave the same. And that's particularly the case once at the age of about two, they come to realize what their own sex is, and they know which side of this great, terribly important social divide they belong. I think there's one of the delusions of gender is that we tried gender neutral parenting, and that was the great social experiment that failed. Gender neutral parenting is the experiment that never took place.
And let me ask you then, how does that sound to you? Can you buy that maybe you've created the differences that you see in your own kids in?
Oh, I'm sure that I was not able to succeed in gender neutral parenting. I mean, I did try to bring them up in their early years as much away from the commercial and overt gender-determining behavior type of things as I could. But, you know, obviously, we live in such a world. But I would say we live in such a world because there are innate differences, probably. I mean, I would say that would be where I would say, you know, there's nature and there's nurture. And where the balance is debatable. But the fact that it's mostly one or mostly the other, I think that is what we need to study.
Anne, I appreciate your call very much. I want to get one more right here from Sherry in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
A couple of comments, and I do agree with most of what your guest speaker is saying, but I've always been told that I think like a man.
And what do people mean when they say that, Sherry?
Well, as far as I could get with the person, a couple of people who've told me that is philosophically, I think they're saying I'm more logical than they expect.
Okay.
Is what I think they're getting at over thinking about the conversations we were having.
Okay.
And secondly, just a couple of days ago, I read an article about how they tested men when women cry for emotional reasons, sadness or upset, not for, you know, joy or things like that. But when women cry like that, men's testosterone levels go down.
They're put off by that.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the men that I've had in my life don't like me to cry. Now, I'm older, so it could also be a generational thing. But for the most part, they don't like you to cry and get upset over things that maybe they wouldn't cry and get upset over, and so they can't get why you are.
How does that speak to this gendered? How does it speak to this gender difference question in your mind, then, Sherry?
Well, I think maybe it's hormonal. Some of the differences, I think, a lot of them obviously are taught. Probably the majority, but there seems to be some truth to the testosterone thing.
Yeah.
And the hormonal thing that makes men less emotional and by implication less empathetic.
Sure, we've got it. Maybe it's not the brain, Cordelia, but it's hormones. Does it make a difference?
It's interesting that you should mention that study because I actually commented on it for USA Today.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's probably important to point out is that the researchers were quite explicit about saying that they had no reason to think that women wouldn't respond in a similar way to men's tears. It's just that they happened to collect women's tears because it was easier. And as I said, they didn't have any particular reason to think that women wouldn't respond the way to the tears of men or to the tears of children. And I think what's really interesting about this study is that it does show, I mean, my position is not to say that our brains and our hormones aren't, of course we have brains and we have hormones and these are the basis of our behaviour. And my position is not one of anti-biology, but it's actually what that study was a very nice example of how the social environment, the people around you, actually influence your biological state. They actually affect your hormones, how they affect your brain. And one of the points in my book that I think Tom touched on earlier is that, you know, we tend to think about hormones and brains and behaviour is a sort of one-way street. So we go from, you know, hormone to brain to behaviour, and it's not the interaction between. There's a sort of inextricable intimacy between our environments and our biology. There's no such thing as a sort of real biology that can be seen sort of free of the environment in which we're in. They're very intimately interlinked.
We have our hunches and our assumptions and our direct experience, and you're asking us to sort of look at and look through, think deeply about those, what might be prejudiced in the way we add that up, what might even be prejudiced in the way scientists add it up. It's kind of hard for civilians out here to weigh that. I want to bring in another psychologist, if I may, right now. Leonard Sachs joins us from Philadelphia, founder and executive director of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education. Single-sex because he does see differences, and he thinks that kind of education might be more effective. He's author of Girls on the Edge, Boys Adrift, Why Gender Matters. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, called that last book A Lucid Guide to Male and Female Brain Differences. I guess that shows us where he stands. You're kind of tough on him, another Cordelia. But Leonard Sachs, thank you very much for being with us. Hello, Dr. Sachs. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
So here we are. We're trying to figure out, you know, you're a psychologist. She's a psychologist. You've looked at the research. She's looked at the research. You say differences, and you're so attached to those that you say we should act on those in social, important social ways, even when it comes to education.
Actually not, Tom. The argument for single-sex education is not related to brain differences, contrary to what Cordelia Fine claims. But indeed, she's looking at a very narrow slice of the research that happens to support her predetermined position. If you look more broadly at more substantive papers, let's look, for example, at the world's largest study of brain development in children, which has been ongoing since 1995 at the National Institutes of Health. Principal investigator for a number of years has been Dr. Jay Geed, who spoke at a conference which I hosted. They have found that sex differences between the brains of children, they've looked at over 3,000 individuals now, 3 through 30 years of age, and these kids come in every 2 years to have their brain scanned, been going on for 16 years now, that the brain of a 6-year-old girl is dramatically different from the brain of a 6-year-old boy, more than 2 standard deviations of difference. But those differences diminish over time. By the time you're talking at looking at adults, say 40-year-old man, 40-year-old woman, you find no significant or very few significant sex differences in the brain. They just recently published another paper on this in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and they published a video, which is available online, and I have a link to that on the essay I wrote for this for Psychology Today last month. You watch this video, it's only about 20 seconds long, and you see the brain of the child and the girl's brain dramatically different from the boy's brain, and then you watch over the ensuing years in this 20-second video. By the time the individual is 22 years of age, the sex differences have almost vanished.
And you take from that that the difference is innate, that it's that you're going to find it indeed at the beginning of life, and that it's made less, not more, by culture, by environment?
Indeed. Hormones have nothing to do with it. And the essential dogma that Cordelia Fine is attacking is that hormones have nothing to do with the brain. And she's quite right. But to conclude from that, that these differences are not innate is simply not factual. And I cite a number of studies where they have done post-mortem studies on infants who died in the first few months of life. And you find in those post-mortem studies dramatic sex differences in the brain. After the onset of puberty, when girls and boys start making teenage hormones,
I want to put
the
that
sex differences in the brain actually diminish.
But let me ask you first, if you don't think there's an essential difference, why are you pushing single-sex education if it's not about the brains of
It has
of
nothing to do with the brain.
Well,
it's
then
about
why
social
do it?
Justice.
Social justice.
For exactly the reasons that Hillary Clinton said on the floor of the United States Senate September 7th.
Girls are victimizing boys or vice versa when they're educated together? Then where's the justice coming?
Not at all, Tom.
Where's justice coming?
What Senator Clinton said is that if you live in Boston, if you live in Philadelphia, if you live in Washington, and you think that your daughter might benefit from a girls' school, you have many wonderful choices. There's just one little problem. They're going to charge you in excess of $20,000 a year.
All children
do not learn the same. Some girls might do better in a girls' school. Other might do better in a co-ed school. If you have a lot of money, you get to choose.
Let's park that. I get it, because money's not the point here. But Cordelia Fine, what about Leonard Sachs looks at this long-term study and says, well, there it is, differences early on, diminishing over time. It seems to point the arrow in the opposite direction when it comes to environment and its influence.
Okay. One thing I would just like to start by saying is that I'm quite surprised by Leonard Sachs's statement that he doesn't draw on brain research, that he's not promoting single-sex schooling on the basis of differences in the brain. I appreciate that there are a number of different factors that Leonard Sachs thinks are relevant to the question of parents having the option of single-sex schooling, mm-hmm. but in my book, I actually refer to neuroimaging studies that Sachs himself presents in his book, Why Gender Matters, as evidence for the need to teach boys and girls separately because of brain-based differences. So I do find it rather odd that he's saying now that
go
it's
to
not
the brain development question itself. Then.
In the brain.
Point taken. Point
so,
taken. What about
so
the
I actually have taken a look at this latest study that Leonard Sachs refers to, and it's been well known for quite a long time, over 100 years, that the male brain is approximately 10% larger than the female brain on average. And this in itself obviously creates sex differences. For a long time it was thought that this was why women were less intelligent than men. Now they realise that that there isn't that relationship. But it actually creates, the sex differences in size creates a real difference for interpreting and understanding
the
sex differences in the brain.
The authors explicitly reject that hypothesis. They write on page 16990, and I'm quoting.
I know they do,
some,
but they...
Some have argued that sex differences in cortical thickness are driven by sex differences in brain size.
I'm glad you've read the paper
reason,
so carefully.
We recalculated the rate of cortical thickness loss at each vertex.
Okay, Cordelia, what do you make of that? What do you make of that, Cordelia?
Well,
they
I would
explicitly
say that there,
reject that hypothesis.
No, okay, Cordelia?
If it's possible for me to
Yes,
speak.
Please do.
Okay. What I would say is that it's actually rather difficult to know. Not only is there a problem of the confound of there being a sex difference in size, but there is also the issue is it's actually not completely clear how to control for this effect. So the brain is a rather complicated thing. Do you do it by size? Do you do it by volume? Do you take into account the density and so on and so forth? The way that they controlled for brain size, if we're going to get technical, was a way that I've never seen done before in any paper, so I would actually dispute that they did properly control for brain size. I'd also point out that what they did was they looked at patterns of cortical thinning over time between 9 and 22 years of age. They search for sex differences in the rate of change throughout the entire cortex, and this revealed only one region, the left frontopolar region, where rates of thinning differed between the sexes. Okay, so that was a large sample. They actually found very little of statistical significance.
Leonard Sachs, I want to ask you, Leonard, why does this matter to your mind? Why does it matter? I want to put it to Leonard. I'll give you plenty on this, Cordelia, but if I may, Leonard Sachs, just from
certainly.
Why does it matter whether it's a in the brain difference or an acculturated difference? What's the significance to you of getting this right, whatever right is?
Very simple. I'll give you a very simple example, Tom. How long can you sit still, be quiet, and pay attention? If you ask that question of adults, we find no difference between a 40-year-old man and a 40-year-old woman. But if we ask that question of a 6-year-old girl and a 6-year-old boy, how long can this 6-year-old boy sit still, be quiet, and pay attention compared to the 6-year-old girl? We find it's just about half as long. The sex differences in the brains of adults are very small. The sex differences in the brain of children are quite large.
So you're saying we won't optimize our development if we...
The assessment of 6-year-old boys who have been diagnosed as attention deficit disorder because they couldn't sit still, be quiet, and pay attention.
I'm asking about the elemental importance. Come to that then. Yes. Summarize. What is it?
Yes.
What
because
is it?
These boys are hardwired to be different, and they are being medicated because we have pathologized boyhood. We have made being a boy an anomaly. If you can't sit still, be quiet, and pay attention, then you must be ADD. You need to be on medication, and that's simply false. And the brain research now supports that.
Leonard Sachs, we're going to put that to Cordelia Fine. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us today. Leonard Sachs, author of Why Gender Matters, Boys Adrift, Girls on the Edge, joining us there from Philadelphia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about men and women and whether there is really a fundamental difference in their brains. My guest is Cordelia Fine, psychologist and author of the new book, Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism create difference. It may or may not be in the brain. Certainly there's a lot out there that pushes different genders in different directions. Here's Martha Stewart. She invited Jennifer Garner to her house to make cookies for her 2010 Christmas special. Garner's first attempt was slightly flawed. She gets schooled.
That's too big.
Well, was born in Texas. Okay.
That is no excuse. Now, don't even waste it.
Don't.
No, because that will not look pretty and plump.
It's my first time.
I know,
practicing.
So do it again here.
Pretty and plump women working on cookies, Martha Stewart and Jennifer Garner. Of course, you can go way back. Here's not 2010, but 1937, Little Rascals. This is Hearts Are Thumps. Spanky, played by George McFarland. Alfalfa, played by Carl Switzer. And Buckwheat, played by Billy Thomas. They all swear an oath against Valentine's Day.
We, the He-Man Woman Haters Club.
We, the He-Man and Woman Haters Club.
Promise not to fall for this Valentine business.
Promise. Not to fall for this Valentine business.
The He-Man Woman Haters Club promises not to fall for this Valentine business. We've been getting messages for a long, long time. Cordelia Fine joins us from San Diego. Cordelia, I want to ask you, what about, we don't have Leonard Sex here now, but he's talking about, this push to see everything as the same ends up pathologizing boyhood, as we heard him just put it. Is it possible that we're sacrificing gender singularity on, an altar of equality or sameness?
Well, I acknowledge the concern that that there might be something harmful about ignoring differences between the sexes. And I certainly don't think that we should pretend away real and reliable and scientifically established differences in ability and achievement, although at the same time I think it's important to recognise just how surprisingly malleable gender gaps actually are, depending on time, place, and even the social context. But I think it's very unhelpful and dangerous when we're trying to understand these differences to misrepresent what the neuroscience tells us and prematurely conclude that they are due to differences in hard wiring. I think that's the real issue here. And I think what's actually ironic is that we all know that there's an extraordinary variability, within men, within boys, and there's an extraordinary variability within women and within girls. And we can argue about the degree of difference and the origin of those differences. And I know that Sachs doesn't think that we should put girls in pink boxes and boys mm-hmm. in blue boxes. But when you start talking about boy brains and girl brains, that is really exactly what you are encouraging teachers and parents to do. You're saying, boys' brains are like this and they need this kind of teaching for English or this kind of teaching for maths, and girls' brains are like this and they need this kind of teaching for English and this kind of teaching for maths. And that's actually, in a way, discouraging the idea that you should be teaching the individual rather than, a boy.
So how do we get this thing right? I mean, I don't know if I'm right or not, but I hear in your maybe motivation, a kind of push for gender freedom or gender justice here. You're pushing back against an impulse, as you say, for old-fashioned stereotypes to be sort of dressed up again in modern technology, modern science. But then what if we're also finding there are differences in that science? I mean, you say no. Other scientists say yes. Can we overshoot on the push for equality? We've seen all kinds of indicators recently that despite, pay disparities and all kinds of problems, women have made a lot of progress in this world. Do you have any fear that I shouldn't say overshoot in terms of equality, but rather in the interest of, in the interest of equality, we underestimate pushing for equality, we underestimate differences that may be there. Is that a risk?
Look, I think there's a, when people sort of hear the thesis of my book or the sort of, I guess, the side of the line, mm-hmm. the battle line that mm-hmm. that my book comes on, they assume yep. that I was sort of politically motivated. That's actually not the case. What happened was that I read a book as a parent, actually happened to be Leonard Sachs's book, mm-hmm. and I was interested. I was, oh, gosh, this is extraordinary. And I looked, being an academic, I looked up the neuroscientific study on which this claim about the way that boys and girls process negative emotion was made, and there was this extraordinary disconnection between what the study showed and the sort of educational implications that Leonard Sachs drew from it. And I started to look at other popular books, and I noticed misinformation that was, you know, frankly, even worse. And I became interested in this because I thought, well, you know, the brain is, neuroimaging is a very sort of seductive technology. It can change how we think about ourselves. And also from my the first book that I wrote, A Mind of Its Own, I knew how powerful gender stereotypes can be. So as I explained in the first part of the book, our minds are actually exquisitely socially attuned and they're surprisingly sensitive to gender stereotypes. So when gender is pushed into the psychological background, it's actually remarkable how similar the behaviour and thinking of males and females become, even in domains where traditionally the sexes would behave differently. But when gender is made salient, there's a kind of ripple effect on the mind and our thinking and our behaviour and the way we perceive other people and the way we perceive ourselves becomes more consistent with gender stereotypes. So it has a kind of self-fulfilling effect.
I have a Facebook question for you right along those lines, if I may. It's from Pat, of all things. So we got a gender-neutral name, but maybe. It says, Tom, could you ask the author to reconcile her views with the well-researched claims made by evolutionary psychologists that there is no blank slate and that evolution makes the sexes different for an advantageous reason? And I've actually got another one here from David. It says, if evolution saw fit to give us different body types, wouldn't it be a huge oversight on its part not to give us specialized brains as well? What about that vein?
Well, look, I think evolutionary psychology, or certain flavors of evolutionary psychology, perhaps the more popular versions, are really based on the idea that you're kind of the mind that you're going to have, the brain that you're going to have, is sort of already in there. It's already in the genetic code that's been sort of molded over years of, centuries of evolution. Whereas, really, I think in terms of there's been a kind of conceptual revolution in developmental biology that sees brain development as being much more inextricably involved with the experience that the brain gets throughout the course of its lifetime. And as Brian Wexler puts it, what this means is that our capacity to adapt is much quicker than sort of changes in the genetic code itself, because we can change our environments in quite extraordinary ways, you know, within a short period of time. And what I would suggest is that actually what biology offers us is not fixedness but flexibility. So the primatologist Frances Burton, she looked at looks at monkeys, and what she found there was that throughout species, different species of monkeys, that there is always sexual division of labour. So, you know, there'll be some kind of monkey troop tasks that the males always do, the females do the others, and sometimes, you know, they do both. But what's interesting is how those tasks are divided changes across species, and actually sometimes even within species. So within the very same species on one part of the island, you can have completely hands-off dads, whereas in the very same species in another part of the island, you can have fathers who are very actively involved in infant care.
But whatever it is, you're saying eon after eon, culture or environment jump on the brain and to teach it to be this or that. But in fact, what at base, you're saying it is a blank slate. It is these are mirror images, or these are copies of one another, male, female, doesn't matter.
No, I'm not suggesting that we're blank slates. But what I'm saying is that the evidence that there is some sort of hardwired difference, and the usual claim is that males are hardwired to understand the world, to manipulate the world, whereas females are hardwired to be more empathic, more compassionate. Well, look, you can talk evolutionary psychology, you can come up with nice arguments as to why that might be the case, but when you actually look at today's men and women, you find that men aren't superior at, understanding other people's thoughts and feelings. You find that male and female infants are equally good at understanding the world. You have to make your theories, evolutionary psychology theories, compatible with the actual reality of men and women. And, you know, alongside that point, I would say that, you know, the very concept of hardwiring is kind of losing its usefulness as a concept, given the changing way that we now think about brain development.
Well, people come down all over on this. Here's Tanya, who writes to us, the theory of the hardwired difference is a reality. It is a fact, period. Then you've got Wendy, who writes, our brains are the same. To think more logically or emotively, these things can be taught and with discipline achieved. Miro says, clearly brains are shaped by both genetic and environmental influences. There are some pervasive hormonal differences, but our brains are much, much more similar to each other than they are different. Mary in Knoxville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello. Hey, before I ask the question I really want to ask, I got a quick one about the tear experiment.
Yes.
Did they check on how women responded to the tears or only how men responded to the tears?
As I read it, this was an Israeli experiment. They collected, I believe, women's tears and, you know, I don't know, waved them under the noses of men. I think it only went one way, Mary.
Well, it should have gone both ways. So anyway,
okay.
The question that I called about is, first of all, I'm going to say my experience real quick. Mm-hmm. I taught shop. I also went to graduate school in psychology.
Taught shop as in industrial shop, like building things shop?
Yeah, I taught shop, mm-hmm. and I also helped build my own house because I got pretty good with woodworking. So
great.
Then when I had a daughter, and by the way, I moved to a farm, so I was way out in the country. We had no, at that time, I mean, I'm older. We didn't have internet access when my daughter was young.
Right.
I thought I could make my daughter be a tomboy. She was wearing dresses before I would buy them for her. So that's just my experience. So I kind of got more, a little bit, I thought when I was a psychology graduate student that I believed in total nurture. And then after having kids, I tipped a little bit more towards nature. But here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about, I think I've read or heard of brain studies where when women have kids that oxytocin is, I don't know, that it's in their brains and that it's partly counts for the maternal instinct
mm-hmm.
or maternal behaviors that you see and that's not present in men at that time,
okay.
at least if I'm understanding correctly. So I'm wondering how that fits in. I think the author sounds pretty balanced in her approach, but how that fits in with her book or if it was brought up in her book.
Mary, I love it, and I appreciate your call, and I hope you'll call again. House building, shop teaching, daughter in a dress before you can buy it. Mother, I appreciate your call. What do you say, Cordelia? First on her experience with her daughter, you know, raised in a sort of a back-to-nature almost vacuum there and still wants that dress so quick. And then what about oxytocin, pregnancy, and what may happen there, I don't know, to the fetus or to the mother herself, to the carrying the child in terms of the brain?
Well, I think everyone would truly agree that that girls aren't hardwired to want dresses per se. You know, presumably if little girls went around with sort of underwear on their head then as standard, then that would be what she would go for, and that to me would be an indication.
So you're saying even there, even though here's Mary who builds her own house, who teaches shop, you know, teaches guys, I don't know, I guess how to, you know, cut and saw and for all I know weld, and she lives out in the country and she feels like her daughter's pretty well isolated from a lot of cultural influences, and she sees her wanting that dress, and you say, no, it's still culture, it's still nurture.
Well, look, one thing to say is I think often parents feel that because they, you know, they hate the pink frilly dresses, they hate the Barbies, they hate the guns, if their children nonetheless want these things, then that must be hardwired. And I think that's a very sort of that's a very passive view of how gender socialization takes mm-hmm. place, and it doesn't recognize the fact that children are very motivated to self-socialize. They know what tribe they belong to, they want to belong. I can't remember the
Mary.
Name of the caller.
Mm-hmm.
If Mary's daughter had literally never seen any child, any girl wearing a dress or no women wearing dresses, then perhaps mm-hmm. one might just say that she just liked the look of a dress, not necessarily anything to do with the fact that she had, you know, a particular chromosomal state. I mean, I think it's extraordinary to say that we might be hardwired to like dresses. People haven't worn dresses, you know, throughout our evolutionary history. This is the problem with, you know, sample sizes of one.
What about the chemical question? She's thinking oxytocin or something in pregnancy, yes?
Look, I think so. The general point to do with hormones is, as I mentioned before, we tend to think that, you know, men and women have a particular hormonal state and that makes them, you know, behave in particular kinds of ways or be better or worse at different kinds of things. First point to make is that often, you know, there's this problem, which I call the problem of sex and premature speculation, so that, you know, we get a bit of data and then we kind of go overboard on it. So for a long time, it was thought that men were better at visual spatial skills because of higher levels of testosterone. But actually, you know, the data are just a real mess. There doesn't seem to be a relationship between these things. But I think another important point, which comes back to the tear study, is that our hormonal states are actually influenced by our environments. And this goes for men too. So when men spend time in the company of their newborn children, they also change hormonally, and, you know, one might imagine in ways that might make them, you know, psychologically better able to take care of their children. This is why I say that biology gives us flexibility rather than fixedness. And in a sense, what this means is that gender, by which I mean, you know, the sorts of roles that people tend to make, tend to have, or the inequalities that exist, and so on and so forth. You know, they become part of our biology. They become sort of incorporated into ourselves. So if you're the one taking care of the child, then that will, you know, influence your biological state. If you're out there on the trading floor being aggressive, that will influence your hormonal state, and so on and so forth. We have to stop thinking about this relationship from, you know, brains and hormones to behavior as a one-way street, and sort of understand just how inextricable it all is.
There's so many callers and questions we can't get here today. Let me just ask you one more. What is it that you're fighting for here? Is it accuracy? Is it women's rights? Is it something else?
Look, my book it's a science book. So there are scientific claims. There is a scientific claim that science has shown that the male brain is predisposed, hardwired, as Simon Baron-Cohen.
Which many assert. I've got many callers, even doctors I can't get to who don't have time, saying, that's proven, that's done.
Well, I would say, read my book. Take a look. Yeah, okay. I was surprised myself. I was, I didn't come to the book. I expected to say, let's not exaggerate this, you know, this evidence for differences in the brain.
So is it just accuracy then, or are you fighting, I don't know, for women or what?
Oh, well, not just women. I mean, I think these gender stereotypes are actually very insulting to men too. The idea that men, you know, are these sort of emotional oafs and incompetents, that they're lacking in compassion. I mean, I think these are, you know, Gloria Steinem puts it as a libel on men and women. It's about the science, and it's about fairness.
Flexibility, not fixedness. We'll keep that phrase in mind, and we appreciate your work. Cordelia Fine, author of Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. Cordelia, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.